Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Modo Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Modo Casino, the only app worth your time.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details.
Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
Final hour, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on this Wednesday afternoon, ESPN 102.5. The game, every Wednesday at this time, we bring in Chris Mason, former Predators goaltender, Willie's partner in the booth on Fox Sports Tennessee, and hopefully we will indeed be talking about games we're watching, whether it's on television. I'm not sure. I don't know if we're going to be watching in person, but certainly watching on television. And we get a little bit closer to maybe the return to play for the National Hockey League. And what everybody's trying to figure out, Chris, said you never experienced this in your playing days, but what is it like? Well, I guess, wait a minute, I shouldn't say that. What will the play be like whenever you've been sitting and not doing – and you know this. This is different than even an off season, right? Because in an off season, you have a schedule. You have like a routine, even in an off season, where this has been even different than an off season. Truly, what is it going to look like, the play, when indeed the National Hockey League comes back?
I think it's going to look the same. I think at the start, but it's going to be like the beginning of the season. It's going to be anyone's got a shot, anyone's got a chance. It's been such a big layoff. And you mentioned too, you know, normally when the guys are off in summer, whether it's a lockout, you can skate and you can get that on ice conditioning. This is a different story. And I know, you know, at first it's going to be weird, but I bet these guys just can't wait to get on the ice, get going again. And I really think that they have enough time, you know, from now when you start the optional workouts and you're allowed to get back on the ice to when it actually starts. I don't know if it's going to be end of July or August, and they'll have a couple exhibition games. Maybe the first couple of games, I think those exhibition games are huge, but I really do think they have enough time to get back up in good shape. Game-wise, I don't know. That's the tough one. But when you think about, you know, you think about a normal training camp, there's six exhibition games. Maybe the guys play three, you know, the big guys, you know, some of the third or fourth line guys and third pair might play four games. So it's not too much different. But I think starting, I just really think they have to make sure they do give the guys enough time and they be careful. You know, you got to be tentative in training camp. You can't all of a sudden start training camp and go, you know, 110% right away and just go all out. I think you got to ease into that and make sure that you're really managing the rest. And I know they will. You know, the player safety is one of the most important things in the game, obviously. So I think when the game starts, these guys, they're so good. They're just so good now. I think it'll be, high-end hockey, no question.
We see teams come back in playoff series all the time in the National Hockey League. It's pretty amazing to see, you know, it's probably more in hockey than any other sport. I think baseball has gotten better of comebacks in series over the years. I still think hockey has the best comebacks. Down 3-2 in a series does not mean this series is over at all. So we had a caller earlier in the show say, what about in these – best of five series, you know, when they're trying to whittle this thing down to get to the 16 teams, and you've had this big layoff and coming back from that, and you're down 0-2 in a series in a best of five, what will be the mentality where before, as I just said, you know, you just never know in hockey, but do you think that'll change if a team is like, man, come on, we're down 0-2, it's a best of five, we've been off for months and months and months, we're not winning this. Let's pack it up and get ready for next year. What do you think the mentality will be for players?
Well, I don't think that'll be the mentality for sure. I put it this way: if you're in a best of seven and you're down 3-0, that's a bigger mountain to climb than two. You only got to win three games to win the series, so it's going to be tough. I just think these guys are going to go out there and get into this. These games that mean so much and how big they are and what's at stake in a best of five, it's going to be unbelievable. But I don't think you'll see that mindset. I think you're going to see these guys are just ultimate professionals. They're going to, you know, down 2-0. They're going to, if I'm in that dressing room, I'm down 2-0 or anybody, they're going to say, guys, we only, you know, you're going to go back to the old cliches, just one at a time. But you win one, you're down 2-1. You got to win this. You win the next one, you're tied. So you only win two games, you tie the series back up and then flip a coin and go for that third one. But I think it's going to be, it's a different mindset, though. It's not like if you lose two games, you still got time in the series, you're headed back home or whatever the case may be, and you're going to go win those two games, then you're back on even, you know, you're back on even up there, and it's down to a best of three. I just think that the mindset is just going to be this one game at a time, and just that's what it always is anyway. You can't look too far ahead or look too far back in the rearview mirror. But again, when we're starting off like this, I just think any team right now, and you look at personnel, everyone's going to be healthy, you know, hopefully barring any training camp or exhibition injuries, but everyone's starting healthy. So you look at teams like Tarasenko or St. Louis that's got Tarasenko back and all the other teams. And, you know, Nashville had, guys banged up. Everyone did. So it's going to be like the beginning of the season where who knows? It's whoever gets hot, whoever gets a hot goaltender, who's ever power plays clicking right off the bat, who's ever, you know, you look at the Preds at the beginning of the year, Forsberg and Duchesne, those guys couldn't be stopped. You know, whoever gets that kind of production or that kind of start, they've got a big opportunity to go on a pretty long run if they can get hot, get those intangibles going. But again, I don't see really much of an advantage to any team here. You know, obviously the good teams like Boston and those teams that are stacked, I think they'll be okay. But again, you never know.
I think there's some worthy candidates, which is why I asked the question. The question is, and I need you just to give one player. You can just give one answer. I asked the show, who is going to benefit the most on the other side? In other words, the break did a lot of good, and you're going to see a different player when it comes to someone on the Predators roster. Chase said Ryan Johansson. Willie said Victor Arvidsson. I said Pekka. Who would your answer be?
Well, if I'm given one, I agree with all those. They would all be in that category for me. But for me, I'm going with Pekka, just simply because, obviously, if you're starting right now or at the end of this, you know, when the season ended, you're going to go, you're riding juice. He was on fire. But this has been a complete off season, and it's starting all over again. So the decision for me to start goaltenders based on what happened before the season ended is tough. Because it's so long ago. So I don't know, and I'm guessing, you know, a lot of these decisions on who teams start in goal is going to be based on training camps, maybe the first exhibition game. You know, let's say this is just hypothetical. Let's say Juice struggles in his exhibition game and Pekka's lights out. What do you do? You know, it's going to be a tough decision. Do you go say, well, Juice was awesome at the end of the season. He was, you know, we're going to run him into playoffs. That was 3 months ago. So it's going to be very interesting to me. And Pekka's been, you know, he got off to an unbelievable start this year. He's just 8-1 or whatever it was, 9-1 or 8-1-1 or whatever it was. So I think Pekka, to me, is the one guy that I think could be the biggest X factor in this whole thing.
Talking to Chris Mason, at Mace, you think about Arizona. And I think they have a similar decision that they're going to have to make in goal. Would you agree?
Oh, I 100%. That's, you know, they're a good, hardworking team, really, really defensive. They got some offensive weapons. They got a couple guys. Phil Kessel was having a tough year, and we talked to Tyson Nash, Matt McConnell, in our little round table there, and they mentioned him. It's perfect for guys like that. You know, Taylor Hall, but again, Antti Raanta and Darcy Kemper, two guys, you know, who's ever playing hot, and Kemper seemed to be taking over the last couple of years. Raanta's had some injuries. So who do you start? I don't know. What if Kemper comes back and he's, you know, average at training camp, and then his first exhibition doesn't go well, and Raanta's lighting it up. That's, coaches are going to have a really tough decision, and you're not going to see coaches waiting around after game one in that situation. Let's say, you know, they do start Kemper because of his track record the last couple of years, and all of a sudden he stinks out the joint in game one. I think you're going to see, coaches pulling the trigger a lot quicker than normal in, let's say, a best of seven series. This is pretty unique, and especially in that position. The goaltending position, because they're gonna win and lose you hockey games. That's the biggest difference maker in having a big playoff run, is having that goaltender hot. So you got to pick the right one, and if you don't, you got to switch quickly, especially for the teams playing in the best of five.
Yeah, I think it'll be some really tough decisions to be made after game one for a lot of teams. So Mace, let's look at some of the awards. They're voting on them right now. You and I, as NHL broadcasters, vote on the Coach of the Year, the Jack Adams Award. And I know we were texting back and forth with Hal. There's a lot of candidates. You could really make a strong case to win it for at least a half a dozen, if not more. I went with Jared Bednar as my number one. I thought he had a great year. But have you decided who you're going to vote for?
You know, it's funny. I was just on the phone with my best buddy. He's a coach. He coaches in Colorado's American League affiliate. And the same thing. There's six guys that I it's hard to order them, too. I'm just having trouble because there's so many guys that I think are worthy of consideration in winning that award. I have it written down, and I haven't sent it yet. I just got the email. There's 3 hours left to vote, so I'm crunch time right now. But I have it written down initially. I've got Bednar, Vigneault, and Tortorella just because, Columbus this year is absolutely decimated. You know, they had American League team, half their team at some points of the season, and they found a way to hang on. But, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of people are picking Sullivan in Pittsburgh to win the award. Tippett and Edmonton, I thought, did an unbelievable job. There's so many guys, I think, that can be inconsiderate. Travis Green, they fell off kind of at the end. But, he did an unbelievable job in Vancouver. I'm probably missing somebody right now. Craig Berube, I mean, you know, he comes in. Obviously, they win the Stanley Cup, but starts out the year. They're top of the Central Division. They did it pretty much without Tarasenko the whole year. So there's a lot of guys that I think could win it. And it's hard to pick three. But right now, I have it written down right now, and this is not final. It's just my first kind of initial one. I have Bednar first, Vigneault, Tortorella.
And the other thing that is happening is all the other awards, and for Nashville fans, they would certainly like to see Roman Josi win the Norris. And all of these numbers that we were crunching and looking at before the season paused, we kind of drudged them back up because all of a sudden it's time for the decision to be made. It's kind of an odd way to go about it. And I wonder how that will influence the vote by the people they're doing. I think it's the sports writers that vote for the Norris.
Yeah, it is. That I think, you know, I don't know if this is a real thing, but I feel like, you know, bigger markets, if you're an Eastern team, a lot of the media you're going to see in Toronto is going to see Washington a lot more. And maybe that's just because I feel, players that I've played with have got snubbed before, Shea Weber in particular. I just think he's so deserving of this award. And I hate that, you know, the Norris Trophy is turned into, it feels like an offensive award. So the best offensive defenseman, when it's, I just feel it's the best defenseman. And I think without a doubt, and we try to take our bias out of this. Obviously, we get the luxury of watching Josi every single game, and we see how good he is, and we see how valuable that he is to this team. They would not have made the playoffs this year without Roman Josi. That's a fact. And the impact that he has, the way that he creates offense, by himself, the way he gets up the ice, leads the league. You know, he's one of the top in the league at zone exits, carrying it through the neutral zone, zone entries, and that's going against guys like Connor McDavid and all these other top players, Nathan MacKinnon, all these, you know, elite forwards. I just think his value and his all-around game is second to none. There's nobody, I think he's in a class of his own. There's other guys that are really good. There's, you know, Cale Makar who might get there. He's got the potential. Obviously, John Carlson had a great year. He's not a bad defender, but he's not Roman Josi. And I think if you look at his supporting cast of players, I'm not saying he got a ton of freebie points, but if you give the puck to Ovechkin or Backstrom or some of these guys, chances are you're going to have a good chance to have a high point total. So I just think bias out of it. And if you look at all those secondary numbers and all the analytics, you know, I was looking at naturalstattrick.com today and doing a side-by-side comparison. Obviously, Carlson has the points total. Josi's got the goals. But every other category, almost every single other category in the analytic department, scoring chances for, against, high danger, low danger, all of them favor Roman Josi. So I just hope that people voting take the time to really, you know, put some time into it, do some research, just like, you know, we're doing with the coaches. I'm trying to make phone calls, and, you know, I don't see Philadelphia a lot, but I have Vigneault as my second pick just because I feel the job that he's done with Philadelphia has been incredible. So I just hope they take the time to just not mail it in and just say, well, John Carlson's got 75 points. So obviously he's going to win the award. And I've heard some people say that, but I've also heard a lot of people on Twitter that have surprised me in favor of Roman Josi. So I just hope he gets the the love and the respect, and they at least take the time to look into it.
We're talking to Chris Mason, Predators analyst, on the TV side alongside Willie D. And as we continue the awards conversation, you know, the Bill Masterson Trophy, Steve Sullivan won that years back, but Jared Tenorti is the nominee for the Predators. And I think you look at a player like Tenorti, and he's one of those guys that we all noticed in training camp. You liked him out of training camp, but when he joined this roster, I mean, he really made a difference and got a lot of praise from his teammates and the coaching staff, and he's been a nice addition. What have been your thoughts on Tenorti?
Well, first of all, I agree exactly with what you said about him. He made an impact. You know, you talk about making a statement and being a team player. He wasn't even here when a couple incidents happened. Corey Perry hit Ryan Ellis, Bortuzzo and Arvidsson, takes on both of those guys, you know, right out of the gate, the first time they played him when he was in the lineup. What does that tell you? That tells you, you know, you have a good teammate that's going to stick up for your players if he was here or not. He puts that jersey on. He's going to, you know, police, you know, what happens out there and make sure that it doesn't happen again. And that makes a huge impact. Players, other teams, when Tenorti was on the ice in front of that, they played differently, you know, and then this is no knock against any of the other guys, but you know, they're just, they don't have that intimidation factor. They don't have that, a little bit of a mean streak and put fear into the opposition. And he does. And the fact that he's recognized for this award, he's an older player that's played a lot of years in the minors, had a few cups of coffee in the NHL, and some guys are going to go down, they're going to get bitter, and they're going to say, well, you know, I should be here, and this guy, and I'm better than this guy, and I can do this, and you know, you get that bitterness, and it ends up, you know, railroading your career, and you're a career minor leaguer. And he had an opportunity this year, and that's why he wore the C down there, and he's making sure the other guys in the system don't feel the same way, you know. And it's so important to have a guy like that, and now, you know, he got an opportunity, and wow, like he was an effective player. Moved the puck well. I thought, you know, when his first call up, he was a little nervous, got in a little, you know, bit of problem getting the timing down. You don't have quite as much time to make plays in the NHL, but once he settled in and figured it out, I just think he's done an excellent job, and he offers an essential, you know, quality with that physicality that the Predators are going to need, especially in the playoffs when you're going toe-to-toe with some of these teams. And if you match up with a team like St. Louis, you're going to need a big beast like that in front of the net. So I was really happy for him, obviously, and for the Predators, for, you know, they gave him a chance, and he made good with it. So I have a feeling we're going to be seeing a lot more of Jared Tenorti in the future.
You know, you see this around the league that they're some of these unsung heroes, so to speak, but it feels like the Predators in their history have, in David Poile, they have always been good about finding those diamonds in the rough or the bargain bin signings, however you want to call it. You know, we talked to Joel Ward. Joel Ward's a prime example of a guy like that. But what is it about the Predators and them able to find players like a Jared Tenorti or those diamonds in the rough?
It's scouting. It's attention to detail. It's doing your homework. It's finding out what a player's character is like. This has been their MO since day one. You know, all these players that are late draft picks, Pecorine, you know, Victor Arvidsson, all these guys that seem to come out of nowhere, Patrick Hornquist. You go up and down the list of players that they've had that are late draft picks, that are cast-offs from other organizations, whatever the case may be, Thomas Vilkun. There's so many. And it starts with the character of the person, you know, seeing potential, having an eye for talent. Maybe, you know, certain players aren't used the right way or you know, just that, to identify those qualities in a player and to do your homework on their character. And Nashville has been so successful in doing that. And I think it's a credit to their scouting staff, obviously David Poile and the organization philosophy, you know, going to, you know, these remote places, finding these guys and watching them and putting the time in and the effort to really, you know, scout these guys, get to know them on a personal level, talk to them, talk to you know, everyone that knows them. And I think that Nashville just has done an amazing job with that. And they continue to do that. You know, Rocco Grimaldi is another prime example. He played for a few different organizations, got a few chances here and there, but never really got a big opportunity, came in here, you know, had a really good showing at camp. They're really high on him. Sent him down. He did a great job there, and call him back up. And, you know, we know how that story has unfolded. So I just think it's a real testament to the work that the Predators and their scouting staff put into to going and finding players.
As we let you go, Chris, I know you and Willie have had some fun calling the video game action, the next one tomorrow night. Is that correct?
I think so.
That is correct.
Double check. Willie probably know better than I do. I got the phone call, so I know it's Wednesday. So.
Yeah, today's Wednesday. That's right. We're still trying to get in our routine, right? But yeah, tomorrow night another doubleheader. Tomorrow is game four. In fact, it's a pair of game fours. Game four of the simulated Stanley Cup. I guess they call it the virtual Stanley Cup. Predators and Flyers. Predators, if you're not following, won game three last night to take a 2-1 lead over the Flyers for the virtual Stanley Cup. That's at 7 o'clock. Mace and I will call that one. And then at 8 o'clock, it is the Golden Classic, Predators and the Penguins, game four of the 2017 Stanley Cup final. They showed game three last night, and Mace, I got to tell you, it was – I had not watched it. You know, it's been hard to go back and watch those games. Of course, it was easier to watch last night because they won, and I knew they were going to. But just watch them produce the starting lineups, and that will give you goosebumps. You know, they're chanting for Pecorino. It's just the buzz in there. And NBC, I thought, did an excellent job because I didn't realize this just sitting in the arena at the time. They pretty much allowed Paul McCann to steal the show. Like, they just turned it over to him, and they just carried the whole pregame ceremony because they knew it was so amazing.
Well, it's one of those memories I think that we all have. Obviously, the way that it ended was bitter for everybody, but when you have a chance to look back and, you know, watch a game like last night and to, you know, you kind of say, oh yeah, that was unbelievable. I've never heard in Nashville, as we all know, Smashville's the loudest building in the NHL on any given night. And it's always full of energy and electricity and, you know, we're always pumping, right? But that was just, it's a level that I've just never experienced. And it was nonstop, and it was inside the building, it was outside the building, it was all over the city. And, you know, to watch that and to see, you know, kind of remind yourself, because when you do look back, you remember, you say all the things that I just said and you remember that, but you don't remember exactly how loud it was, exactly how nuts the fans were, you know, when they came out for warm up. The fans were going absolutely crazy. The building was almost full in every warm-up, and they're cheering Pekka when Pekka came back from Pittsburgh. Had a tough couple games. He comes out in game three, and they're there. There's signs everywhere, and everyone starts chanting his name. It was just, man, it was just unbelievable. And it's good to go back and watch those, and you know, because if we didn't have this pandemic, I don't know if I would have went back and watched these games maybe till later on, you know, in life, but special time, and you know, who knows? Hopefully this year we can get back there.
And I also, it was all coming back in waves, right? I enjoyed it, and I wish I watched them in order, but the night before we showed the Golden Classic on Fox Sports Tennessee, and we'll show the other game Thursday that they won, game four, which is also a great performance. But they showed Game 6 on NHL Network on Monday night, and I had not watched the Colton Sissons goal that was waved off. You know, it's imprinted in my mind from where I remember exactly where I was. I was just walking back in to my seat. I was coming out of the media area right as the period began, so I was standing because I couldn't get to my seat because the puck was in play when Colton Sissons put it in. So I remember it vividly, but then watching how it was covered by the behind-the-scenes part of it, with the referees mic'd up, with the coaches mic'd up, Mike Fisher mic'd up, the behind-the-scenes look, and then how NBC covered it when it was live. Man, I mean, and Mace, you know this. You've played hockey your whole life. Sometimes the whistle blows early, right? It does happen. So it was the right call. It's a rule that we're always trying to figure out. How could you ever get around that? Because there's some wrong calls made every year with that, but what a time for that. You're just thinking to yourself, what if, right? If they score that goal, I just don't see how they lose that game. It may be too simple to say.
Yeah, you know, it may be. There's so many. I mean, you go back to game one of the Forsberg offside. They were all over Pittsburgh. They were all over them. And, you know, Pittsburgh found a way to come back and win that game. They've got, you know, the players that can win those hockey games. Even game two, I thought, you know, Preds were the better team. They had more jump. I think Pittsburgh was tired after their long series. And then you get to that game too, with the goal waved off. And there's so many of those moments in that series that I feel you know, could have obviously changed the outcome in a big way. But that's the part I don't like looking back on. So I like looking back on how natural was and all those sorts of things. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's nothing you can do about it. And I always think, too, when Tampa Bay won and you know, they're playing the Calgary Flames, and Calgary Flames had that goal that would have been a goal now that went over the line, but Javi Bouin got it with his pad, and you know, it crossed, or the skate in the crease one with Brett Hull, all these different types of things, right? You look back, and obviously there have been different outcomes, but you know, it's going to make it all that much sweeter when they actually do win their first one.
Yes, no question. Mace, great stuff as always. I will see you soon, and we'll talk to you again next Wednesday.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Take care.
All right, Chris Mason joining us, talking a little Predators. A reminder, we will be talking Major League Baseball draft at 1:45 today. Our buddy Max Hurst, who follows this backwards and forwards. There's a lot of Nashville flavor to the draft, and round one is tonight. We'll talk about that at 1:45. Darren, Donick, and Chase continues after this.
Well, one of the big news items today was the announcement of the MLS coming back. And they're going to get things cranked up down in Orlando, Florida. Gary Smith, Nashville SC head coach, joined us, kind of breaking the news. First interview since everything was put out there that here in 2 weeks from today, all 26 teams will head down to Florida, and they will get cranked up and start getting conditioning and everything underway as they'll get ready to start their format on July 8th. And it'll have a World Cup feel to it, and you heard a clip from Don Garber, MLS commissioner, that was on Golic and Wingo this morning talking about their return to play, and they're planning on wrapping up the final to that kind of World Cup style tournament on August the 11th. So it'll be interesting to see MLS after just two games from Nashville SC, one at home against Atlanta at Nissan Stadium, and then they went out to Seattle and lost a tough one out there, and they were next up, scheduled to be on the road in Toronto when things came to a screeching halt. So just like we've been talking about, what will hockey look like? What will soccer look like when they come back? How much have they been able to do? I think it's a little bit easier for them to stay in shape and condition. That sport allows it a lot easier than hockey. So I suspect probably nothing really will look that different on the soccer side. I don't know if you agree or not.
It could, I mean, it certainly could. I think that I would tend to agree with you on that. So I don't know what Willie thinks, but, yeah, I do. And that's just kind of where we're at this point, that there, you know, there will be some things like that that come from having to readjust.
You're talking about with the playing in Orlando?
Darren.
So anyway, so they'll get down there in a couple of weeks, and things will indeed get cranked up. On the Major League Baseball side, there's been another proposal. Something slid across the table that will quickly get slid right back, and Major League Baseball seems to be the last team or the last sport that still hasn't figured things out, and who knows where this is going. I don't think we've got any...
Oh, we know they're going to slide it back across the table.
Well, at some point they'll stop sliding because they'll just have to give up and punt. I mean, you can only slide for so long as we sit here on June 10th. I mean, if they're going to get anything in to this point, I mean, the sliding is about to end. At some point, either they're going to shake hands or do a virtual fist bump or what have you, and they're going to agree to something, or both sides are just going to get up and walk away and say, see you in 2021.
It remains to be seen if anybody is going to take a step towards the middle. Neither side has done it yet, not even a half a step. Ken Rosenthal, who I think has done some excellent coverage of this, has proposed a 72-game season. And I don't know if anybody's going to listen to Ken Rosenthal. It makes some sense to me. He tries to be sort of the mediator. He has been talking to both sides throughout this whole process. I mean, the writers know the distrust and the animosity between the two sides better than anybody. So why not have those guys? I think it's an intelligent thing to write write up a little basic compromise. See if it gains any traction through the media. What do you got to lose if you want to see them come back and play? I hope it works. I'm very skeptical at this point. I'm really thinking right now, like a lot of those guys who are covering it, that it's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 55 games. 72 would be better, no question. But I don't know that they can get there. And that just, it makes no sense to me.
Cardinals, St. Louis Cardinals owner Bill DeWitt Jr. said something along the same lines as Chicago Cubs owner Tom Ricketts did, I don't know, a week or so ago, where DeWitt Jr. Went on, I think it was a radio show, 590 The Fan in St. Louis, and said, and I quote, "The industry isn't very profitable, to be honest. And I think
really
the players understand that. They think owners are hiding profits. There's been a bit of mistrust there. It's a bit of a zero-sum
really?
Game. They have by far the best deal of any players in any sport." It's really hard for people to believe that baseball isn't very profitable. I mean, come on.
They generated over $10 billion. They generated $10 billion in gross revenue, more than they have ever generated before. And that was even with attendance being slightly down. What is the value of the Cardinals franchise? What is the value of the Cubs franchise? We're talking about $1 billion. Google it. So, I mean, that is the most ridiculous thing I think I've ever heard. Except, I will say, the players do have it pretty well also. You know, they're sitting here saying, well, you know, we've given in on the last couple of negotiations. Well, whatever, man. You guys, I mean, what the earth is still rotating, and players are still making a ton of money. A ton! Compared to some other sports, right?
They
NFL.
They have the biggest contracts in sports.
Yeah. They're guaranteed contracts, even
no
if you
cap.
Get hurt. And they make way more money than the best NFL players in most cases.
I get it.
Right?
They
By
play
and
a longer
it's not
season.
Even close.
I get it. But still, they have the biggest contracts in sports.
Yes.
If I miss the $300 million contract somewhere else,
no.
No, the,
well,
NBA's,
the NBA's
a little,
got some
NBA's
high
close.
Paid guys, and
yeah.
they're guaranteed. There's less players, and that allows the top players to really do well. But by and large, I think Major League Baseball players, there's nothing to complain about, and there's nothing to complain about for the owners. That's what I don't understand. The game is in a pretty good spot revenue wise. You're going to have a rough time this year. It's a given, and it's not anybody's fault.
But
so
how could DeWitt Jr.
make a deal?
But how could he
say that?
How could he say the industry isn't very profitable, and that the players? And I think the players understand that. Do you? You think the players understand that? You think that we're sitting here on June 10th having these same conversations because the players understand that you don't make very much money? That the profit margin is not what you think in baseball? Really? I find that hard to believe.
I just think – I take it it's another way for the owners and the players to, you know, just throw darts at each other, because that's all this is. I mean, at this point, it doesn't matter what either side says. It's just coming across of they're going to disagree and they're going to blame each side for something. And that's why we're in this mess. And that's why that I'm at the point whenever there's a proposal that comes out, I'm just like, whatever, just let me know if they're playing again. And you know what we said, that it's probably going to end up, they'll play 48 or 50 games or what have you. And just, it's a missed opportunity for them while all the other sports have figured it out and they've worked together. Do they all agree on everything? No. I mean, you almost had MLS that you were just talking about. They almost had a lockout, but they figured it out, and they avoided that.
Pretty quickly, too.
Yeah, because they know how bad of a deal it would be and how detrimental it would be for the sport. I mean, not just looking at a team like Nashville SC that's two games into their existence, but the entire league. It's a league that's expanding left and right, and you think they're going to risk hurting that momentum and the growth that they have by having a lockout? No, they're smart enough to know. And you know, maybe all the players aren't happy with the deal that they came up with, but they still came up with a deal and they're getting back.
I give them credit for taking the deal. They're not happy about it, but also they definitely at this point don't have the leverage that the Major League Baseball Players Association has. you know, basically the MLS was saying, this is all we got, man. And if you guys don't take this, then you're locked out. You're going to Orlando, and we're going to pay your salaries this year. Here's what we're paying. But the players, I think what they're upset about is they had to agree to things down the road that they didn't want to have to cross yet. The baseball guys don't even have to do that. All they have to do is really try to figure out this year. The CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, ends at the end of next year anyway. So they have to go through a whole nother negotiation. But they're already getting into things that they think will affect next year when that is the worst thinking right now. Take care of 2021 in 2021. Figure out the short term now, because it's really essential to play. And it's not as important as what happens. There's plenty of stuff that's very legit discussion that will have to take place for the next CBA. But why does that have so much to do with why it's halting this situation right here?
How can you have two owners in the same division both saying the same thing? That the players think the owners are hiding profits. Like, where are they getting that from? Like, that's what I want to know. What is behind two owners in the same division saying the players think we're hiding profits? Like, what does that stem from? I would love to know where that's coming from, because clearly they've been told that by somebody. I don't know who. I don't know if it's agents. I don't know. I don't know if it's Tony Clark. I don't know who's told
it's
them that.
It's age old. They were 1994. You heard that all the time.
I just
open
think
up
it's
the
them
books.
Not trusting
show
each other.
Us the books. All of that stuff. It's just a mistrust. There is a deep, deep mistrust. And hockey, quite honestly, was in the same spot when they locked out and missed an entire year. That same distrust took place. But this is maybe a lesson that baseball can learn. When you have a salary cap, it's not taboo, right? You can have a salary cap and the players still come out all right. You have more of a partnership. There is more agreements and discussions on what revenue goes into the pot to divvy up. You know, hockey has survived and thrived after sitting out a whole year because of some of these same things that baseball gets stuck on. But, you know, it all starts with the distrust, and they're hiding money, and we can't ever have a salary cap because the world would end if we had a salary cap. It's just wrong. It's the wrong way of thinking.
I don't know what that magic number. Let's end this segment with this. We have to guess a number today. Let's see who's the closest. What's the number of games played? Who wants to jump out
60.
There first? 60?
60.
I'll just go with the number that was thrown at me last week and just stick with it. 62.
I am going to say 48.
48.
I think they're going to screw this up that bad. I wanted 48? I almost said zero. I almost said zero, but I think they'll figure out a way to get something in. But yep. That's what I think will happen.
That's 30% of the game, 30% of the regular season.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's a big problem, and it's something that's going to hurt them for years down the road. But because they can't trust each other and they can't figure out a deal, that's what I think is going to happen.
The MLB draft starts tonight. It'll be aired on ESPN. And we're going to wrap up today's show with Max Herz from the Anchor Down podcast. Austin Martin from Vanderbilt is expected to go top five for sure. I mean, some mocks, second pick overall, third pick overall. He is going to go very high, and there's some local flavor that could be going in the first round tonight of the MLB draft. We'll wrap up the show with Max on the other side of Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Starting at 6 o'clock tonight, it'll be round one of the MLB draft, and it'll be shown on ESPN. Tomorrow will be rounds 2 through 5, and that'll be on ESPN2. And you say, okay, well, what about all the rest of the rounds? No, that's the MLB draft this year. And to help us with that and a lot more, Max Herz, Anchor Down Podcast, is with us right now. In fact, he is in our Wholesale Inc. Game Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. Max, how you doing?
Good. Good to hear you guys. Good to be on with you. Wish I could see you.
I was going to say, it's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, for real. I've been here more than you guys have.
Yes, you have. There's no doubt about that. How weird is it going to be to see an MLB draft with five rounds? So let's kind of set the scene. Let's start there for everybody out there listening, because all the players, and I mean, just think about all the rounds. What's it typically?
40.
Yeah, 40 rounds. So 35 rounds that are going to be exempt from this year's draft that you can just go out there and just – how is it going to work after the fifth round is over with all the players who aren't drafted?
Yeah, it's a bad situation for amateur players. You go from over 1,200 picks in a usual year, depending exactly where the compensatory picks fall. You go from 1,200 picks to 160. There are going to be 160 picks, 37 tonight, 123 tomorrow, and that's it. And the thing that really screws the players, you say, okay, everybody else who wants to sign is an undrafted free agent. Well, for the first time ever, MLB has capped the signing bonus for undrafted free agents, and they have capped it at a very, very low $20,000, which any player with a better option, whether that's remaining college eligibility, which everybody has because even seniors can go back now, there are very few players who are going to want to take that. So the amateur players were used as a bargaining ploy in the first agreement, which, according to the owners, was not an agreement at this point. But the first agreement was a big concession, or a big positive for the owners, was the MLB draft's going to be shorter. The bonuses for the players that are picked are going to be mostly deferred, so they'll get about 10% up front, and then the remaining money will be paid out over the next few years, which isn't usually how it goes. You usually get all that money right away. It's not like a contract where there's deferred money. It is a true signing bonus. So the amateur players who do not have a seat at the table, who are not a part of the Players Association, were screwed by that early negotiation. And because of it, the MLB draft is so much shorter. And you think, I mean, why do the owners want to do this? Obviously, they want to save money. They're not going to save a ton per team because they're still going to be giving out big bonuses in the early rounds. But the big piece of this regards to the big picture of amateur baseball. They want to cut an entire level of minor league baseball. How do you do that? You prevent an entire year's class from coming in until a year later. So this is how organizations are shrinking. A lot of moving parts, and players are the losers.
The Detroit Tigers are going to be on the clock at 6 o'clock. Well, they're on the clock right now. They'll make their pick at 6 o'clock tonight. Is there a surefire number one out there that everybody's identifying as, okay, he's going one, and then let's figure out who's going to? Is there that guy this year, or is there kind of a group that people are speculating could go one overall?
There is. It's Spencer Torkelson, who's Arizona State's first baseman, big-time power. The bat is what is going to play in the majors. He could be in the majors as soon as next year, as many college players who are going in those top 10 picks could be. I would say it's at least an 80% chance that the Tigers are going to pick Spencer Torkelson. The only other player who I think could go 1-1 is Vanderbilt's Austin Martin,
who
is probably going to go number two, which would be to Baltimore. But I think it was between those guys, and I think because the college season didn't happen, Martin did not get a chance to show the power in his bat, which has been the knock if there is one on his game, while Torkelson, that power tool is, I mean, it's a 65 on the 20 to 80 sliding scouting scale, which is MLB star level. And that was proven coming into his junior season just because of how many home runs he hit his first 2 years at Arizona State.
So pretty amazing. Those two guys you mentioned, not pitchers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be mostly bats in the early going. There are some good college arms that are probably going to go between 5 and 10. Asa Lacy, the left-handed ace from Texas A&M, who absolutely owned Vanderbilt when he pitched against them, could go maybe as high as second, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to be position players early, and then you're going to see a good group of college pitchers pick between 5 and 15. I think Lacy will be the first to go. Max Meyer, who's a right-hander from the University of Minnesota, is really good and has risen a lot over the last calendar year. And then another name that Vandy fans know really well, Louisville's Reed Detmers, who pitched in that College World Series opener against the Commodores last year, is probably going to go in the top 10 as well.
Yeah, if you followed SEC baseball, there are a ton of familiar names. The SEC is going to have a bunch of picks. Fair to say, Max, in this first round tonight?
Yeah, always, always. And the format will favor college players just because if you pick somebody and you don't sign them when your team has somewhere between 3 and 6 picks, which is where all the teams sit, I mean, you got to pick somebody you know you can sign. So I think the college players will benefit from that.
What about Robert Hassel, this kid locally from Independence High School? We first heard of him maybe if you go back a few years for the South Nashville Little League team that made it to Williamsport. What's his signability? If he goes 8th to 10th, is he for sure going to sign?
I think so. I think he's going to be put in a position where he can't say no. He's been mocked anywhere between, I've seen as early as 6 or 7. I think that may be a little bit ambitious just because of how many good college players there are. I've seen him as low as 14 or 15, but I think he will go in the top 15. Really, really toolsy, power-hitting outfielder. I mean, his main tool is contact, but he has shown that there's a lot of power. Joe Rexroad wrote a great article about him in The Athletic recently here, just basically getting him on record saying, I could still go to Vanderbilt, but I think the way Vanderbilt recruits, they assign quote-unquote risk levels in terms of signability for everyone they have as these guys commit, usually in their freshman or sophomore years, and move their way up. And I don't know this for sure, but I would say he is without a doubt their highest risk signability recruit. At no point are they expecting him to come, but I think the negotiations with a high school player will be pretty normal, even with the shortened draft. So there's certainly a chance, but he's a great player to have coming out of the Nashville area. Great for Williamson County and great for Indy.
There's another signee that I saw for Vanderbilt that is projected to go in the first round. If they sign, Max, where do they go since there's no minor leagues? So what happens to them for the next 3 years, for example?
They, at least until probably October, they sit around, and the other signee is Pete Crow Armstrong, who's an outfielder from California, from Harvard Westlake, and Vandy is recruiting there a lot. Great baseball school. We hear about those guys pitching in the playoffs against each other every year. Jack Flaherty, Lucas Giolito, the crazy rotation. He has the potential to be kind of a junior Mike Trout, really good defender, and the hitting is what is keeping him from being a sure thing MLB superstar right now, left-handed hitter. I would say if he goes in the top 15, he signs too. But in terms of where they go, there's going to be some sort of expanded instructional league, health pending, in the fall for everybody involved. So basically to try and get players a year's worth of minor league at-bats in maybe a month. And I think that will be fun to watch if it happens as scheduled. But there's no more rookie ball. I think this is the last year that the draft is going to be in June. I think the draft will be later. Players that get drafted will basically go to instructs and go to spring training complexes and kind of have a tutorial and a learning curve, and an orientation is probably the best way to describe it. But rookie ball is basically going to go away. But I think the positive for the names that you hear tonight, Austin Martin being a prime example of this coming out of Vandy, he probably won't have an at-bat in a game until next year. But that first at-bat could be in AAA. It really could be. So I think the best players are going to get fast-tracked because of this. I think a lot of guys will kind of get lost in the shuffle, and we've seen the headlines over the last few weeks as all these teams have cut dudes left and right. But the path is going to change, that's for sure.
Max, good stuff. I'm going to watch tonight, you know, see how this plays out, and see some local flavor hopefully going in the first round this evening. Good to hear your voice, and we'll certainly catch up with you soon.
Yeah, I think Austin Martin second to the Orioles, and Robert Hassel will go in the top 15 somewhere, and then hopefully more Vandy guys on day two. But Vandy could get a lot of guys back. We'll see. A lot's up in the air.
Very interesting. Max Herz, Anchor Down Podcast. You should go check it out, and he'll certainly have a lot to talk about on that podcast, especially if Martin goes number two overall. Remember, that's tonight starting at 6 p.m., the MLB first round draft, and that will be, and I believe Austin Martin is going to be down in Florida, I believe, during the draft. I think I saw that correctly, but it will all start tonight at 6 o'clock. That will do it for us. Another show in the books. Enjoy the beautiful weather outside. Be safe. We want you back with us tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. We'll see you then.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.